And ready to do business. Thank you all for coming again. We have probably a short meeting today, depending on questions, I guess. So
we're going to grill this guy.
I think we'll go ahead. We have a couple of bills to introduce as committee bills, so I'm going to go ahead and open a work session to on the introduction of committee bills. So, Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before you have two legislative council drafts, the first, LC 1375, was brought to us by the Speaker's office. It would establish a consular corps registration plate for use on motor vehicles. The second one is the sixth of six that we got from Monty King with the Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association. This one deals with odometer records, keeping of odometer records.
Thank you, and I'll remind you that this is just a courtesy introduction of bills, and we'll have an opportunity or not later on to debate them. We'll see at that point in time. So this does not obligate anyone in any way to support a bill. And with that,
Madam Chair, I move we introduce LC 2090 dated 1/23 and LC 1375 dated 9/30/08. As committee bills.
Representative Gilman has moved LC 2090 and dated 1/23/09 and LC 1375 dated 9/30/08 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none?
Oh. Discussion. I missed what you said or who you said. Introduce these or ask them to be introduced.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Boone, the first one, LC 1375, was brought to us by the Speaker's office.
Oh, thank you.
The second
I'll vote for that.
The second one, LC 2090, was brought by the Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. No other discussion and no objections? All right.
That's right.
So moved. And I'll close the work session on introduction of committee bills, and we'll call Troy Costales to come forward, and he's going to entertain us for a while and educate us, right?
Mostly entertain us.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, committee members. My name is Troy Costales. I'm the Administrator of the Transportation Safety Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I appreciate the opportunity today to come to you and explain what the Transportation Safety Division does for ODOT and the programmatic areas that we touch and we reach. That every one of us, every day, has some touch to the transportation system and the safety we're in, so we'll cover those for you. Given you three documents. First is the text letter, which has the content items of each of the areas. Within that letter, there are some snapshots of some photos. Those are actually from the slideshow that I'll be presenting to you. So you have an idea of where I'm at every once in a while. I don't have all the slides buried in there, but just some along the way so you can associate that. You do have a full copy of the slideshow. And I will note for you, in one particular place, you have one of the slides as a black square. The reason is I will show you one of our TV ads, a 30-second TV spot, so you have a chance to see that. And you'll also see some little speaker buttons if you're looking at it. I will have a couple radio spots to share with you. And then the print ads are all already buried in the slideshow. And then lastly, the item that you have at your place is the Safety Division's business plan. Director Garrett mentioned in his overview of the department, the STIP, which has a lot of the highway fund and the highway program and transportation development program items in it. I have, through the USDOT, a requirement every year to put forward a plan of what are our objectives, what are our measures, what are the funds that we receive from the USDOT, and how are we going to use them. This is done annually. And I will mention it once we get going about how Oregon deals with this plan in a little bit different fashion than most of the states across the country. And so with that, I'll start in the introduction. So, again, thank you for allowing me to be here to cover the safety division and the highway safety programs within Oregon. I'm going to walk through a little bit of a background to give you a setting of how Oregon fits in on the national perspective and how we run our program here, which, as I mentioned, is different than most of the other states across the country. So for state highway safety offices across the country, generally there are three types of offices that exist. All of the highway safety offices in the country must do data review, must do grants, and must produce this federal spending plan. From there, half of the states, and we're very fortunate on the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California, are all existing in this middle area, but only half of the states go further. Instead of being a contract office where they just dole out money, these half of the states do programs, are involved in training, do media outreach, do some analysis, have responsibility for some programs, and I'll mention to show how Oregon has, through statute, through your delegation, have given my office very specific responsibility for driver education, motorcycle training, and a few others. Only half of my counterparts across the country actually have those types of responsibilities, and only half of them have money beyond the federal. Within my office, I deal with federal funds and with state funds, and Representative Edwards will get a chance to delve into that a little bit later in the Ways and Means process. But then only 7 or 8 of the highway safety offices in this country actually get involved in some policy discussion, actually get to sit here and present to you, and actually work on answering questions and what you're working on and the questions that you may have. Most of my peers across the country do not. They don't get involved in the governor's office or governor-appointed committees, which in Oregon we have 3, nor do they necessarily get involved in legislation, providing information and answering questions that may come from constituents or from individual legislators or staff or the committees themselves. In West Coast, again, 3 of those 7 are right here on the Pacific Ocean. Washington, Oregon, California all do that level of work, but we are essentially a rarity when you look across the country. Would also like to mention at this time, though, I have the good fortune of having a slate of individuals within my division that live and breathe and understand and have an absolute passion for highway safety, for reducing the carnage on our roads, reducing deaths, reducing injuries, reducing the incidence of crashes. And I'm fortunate to also have 3 governor-appointed committees, the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, which is defined in statute, and their 5-member governor-appointed committee, and then 2 that exist by executive order, the governor's DUI committee and the governor's motorcycle safety committee. We staff those committees. They have no budget. They have no staffing. They exist under executive order, but we use them as integral parts of what we move forward, particularly in their 2 subject areas. And then lots of other advocates and volunteers. They stand up. Unfortunately, sometimes they are victims where they raise their hand and they want to get involved in something, and they find a way through our process, because we do a very open, transparent decision process to develop this business plan. Most of our money is from the federal program. Well, in the past, when dealing with USDOT, we weren't always sure what we were going to get. In part because we didn't know from across the country who all was going to apply. A lot of the federal money is they put $50 million in the big bucket in the sky, and what states or territories apply and which ones qualify, then share proportionally that $50 million. So at times we had a little bit of a question as to what amount of money or how much money or what type of money we would get. It was all based on an application process. And early on, most of the money we received was quite colorless as far as safety is concerned. I could deal with things that were youth, safe routes to school, car seats, DUI, motorcycle safety, pedestrian. I could use the money where we, in our business plan, identified the need and use that money towards those programs. But as we moved down the calendar to the more recent time, we weren't sure whether there was a big bucket of money that we were going to get a chance to deal with, or it was a very small bucket of money we were going to get a chance to deal with, in part because, quite often, as you have read, we were doing continuing resolutions, no real congressional USDOT budget, and so we weren't sure what we had. And it created a little bit of a stir to make this business plan be accurate and prudent and fiscally responsible, because we weren't sure on the volume of money that we had. And then somebody decided that they would start to reach into the box of colors. And as we move into today, I have very, very little of this colorless money and a lot of this colored money. I went from a program that had three or four categories of dollars to come into our program that we could use, where now I have 11 different federal programs to use my money. So as much as I would love in some cases to be able to deal with some problems, I'm locked because congressional language and USDOT language colored it into a particular area. And in some cases, there is a trap. And to give you some of those examples, it is what you have to do as a state to qualify to get that dollar. And in some cases, it may not match up with what you, through your policy discussions in the legislature, set as what we want to do with repeat DUI offenders, or what you want to do with suspended or revoked offenders, or how you want to deal with making available booster seats, car seats, infant seats at the hospital when newborns are leaving the hospital. How we have to do certain things certain ways, even though it may not necessarily be the best that we want to put forward, or in some cases, we don't qualify under that criteria and have to forego federal funds because in some cases, coming to you with a policy choice may not be the right thing to do because that trap doesn't necessarily help out Oregon as to where we're heading forward. The money we receive, as I mentioned, I now have 11 categories of federal money. It is very earmarked and very siloed, and I cannot switch money between the areas and have to show through this business plan a very direct relationship of the problems to the money, to the colors of what we spend. Our performance plan, this business plan, how we go through and create it, if you are interested, is in that book. We are very transparent. We involve all three of the governor-appointed committees. We do public hearings around the state. We involve different advocacy groups. Take advantage of people and groups that already exist and plug into their calendar during a setting and get feedback from them of where we want to go and what they want to see done in the area of highway safety. Each area that I deal with, all 25, are structured the same. What's the long-range goal? What's the current data in relationship to that area? Why do we even do any work in this area? What are our strategies for what we're going to try and do next year and the actual projects we fund? Every dime for one half of my biennial budget from you is in this book, state or federal. So if you were to take two of these together, you have my biennial budget of where we're headed, but in the detail down at the project level. We established those performance measures, and this book, 7 or 8 years ago, by the USDOT, was declared as the model that meets what Congress and the USDOT has said as a highway safety performance plan, and there are now 7 or 8 states in the country that have adopted this as the way they portray their overall program. And so, you know, a small pat on the back for something that's quite dry, without any color or any graphs and charts. It's text and numbers. But it is identified as a national model for setting out forward what will be done in highway safety for states and territories. In each of our topical areas, we must identify what we're going to deliver. And you will find the projects and who they're to, attached to a performance measure. Very fortunate for the safety division of the 20-plus department measures, there are 4 or 5 that are highway safety. From my division that we report on. And that goes in front of the Ways and Means Committee as part of that, but it's also part of the Oregon benchmarks and what we say was happening in the state. We show that information. As an example, earlier I gave you the example, we try to take advantage of what's already out there and not add new burden. They're already existing for a reason. There might be a bike ped committee that exists or a regional group that already exists, a coalition of highway safety folks. We'll take advantage of working with them instead of trying to create something new. The last item on this slide is dealing with tighter scrutiny. For about a decade, highway safety offices really didn't have any oversight by the USDOT. That changed 3 years ago. Congress said there are examples of bad spending across the country. We weren't one of them. Neighbor to the north did have a problem, but most of it was in central southeast of the country where there were highway safety monies going for things that weren't necessarily tied to highway safety or the nexus wasn't very tight. So Congress said, USDOT, start reviewing them on a 3-year cycle. We were reviewed 3 years ago. We had no findings in Oregon. They are coming back in August for their next 3-year review, and I don't expect any problems. I also, at times, will mentor other states through phone call and help them out because there are states that do have findings. Been in and around this, just a quick background. This is the start of my 12th year as the administrator of this program. I've been involved in the highway safety program for 21 years. Doing various pieces and parts of this office, other parts of the department, and back to this job. So when you talk about rules and regs, I've lived a lot of them. And we expect a very positive review coming up in August by the USDOT. Within this program, we target. Not only does it say what we're going to fund, but it also mentions what we're not going to fund. And sometimes that's the harder discussion, is to say no. When people find out that you've got money that they might have an interest in locally, or some project or some community event, or they're losing a staff person like today, and they want to retain that school resource officer, they want to retain that local advocate, there are rules and regs about whether we can do it or not. And in some cases, it might not have, I might not have the right funding to even talk about that particular situation. Oregon does a problem-identified selection. We do the data review, and I'll show you that in a couple of the program specifics. We don't say, here's $500,000 for impaired driving. Whoever wants a grant, sign up and send us papers. We don't do that. In part, that puts public entities doing a lot of work on a chance that they might get money, so it's causing them work. And oftentimes, you may actually end up in a situation where you may be granting money to somebody that writes well, but may not be the right place or the problem area in the state that we need to fix. So we do problem identification first. And we'll go out and select who we then talk to about potential grants versus doing an open call, because it's a lot of work on a lot of folks' part that's no guarantee or no link to actually having a product at the very end. As I mentioned, we have 25 programs in this document, but I'm only going to cover 7. In the 1960s, Congress created NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And most of us know NHTSA because of the 4-star crash rating on cars. That's who does it. That's an element of NHTSA. And that was created then to start doing crash testing. But they also created the State and Community Highway Safety Program, which is what relates to my office. Then, in the 1960s, it was all about belts, booze, and speed. That was the 50-plus thousand people in this country being killed every year on the roads, was belts, booze, and speed. It still is. As you look at what happens in Oregon, and this is a 3-year average to show you what's going on with belts, booze, and speed. Common reaction to a fatal crash, that the perception is they were going too fast, they were under the influence, and they weren't wearing their belt. That's just the common perception of the average citizen in this state, that that's why that cataclysmic event occurred and someone died. Too fast, under the influence, and not wearing their belt. The very middle number in those three circles, 45. On average, there are 45 deaths in the state where that is true. Too fast, under the influence, not wearing belts. Where all three of those areas come together. But the number one, biggest number on there inside the circles, 110. Speed too fast. They were sober. They were wearing their belts or in the car seats. They were just going too fast. And I'll explain a little bit when I talk about speed, some of the dynamic of that. But that this diagram, when done in 2005, 2006, just for us, when doing problem identification work on where we want to head and what we want to do, highlighted, when you look at the big numbers on the outside, 268 on average over the last few years of how many people killed in speed-related crashes in Oregon. Now, the no belts area, the reason that's so small, one, we have a very high belt use rate. Number two, you can't wear a belt on a motorcycle where you're a pedestrian or when you're a bicyclist. So that group, the universe, doesn't have those speed and alcohol, could have bicycles with pedestrians involved in their numbers, and so you just have a little bigger starting place on those two than you would in the belt area. But I share that with you, and you have that in the slideshow, just so you have an idea when the big issues of these three still represent 65% of the overall picture. Of all our fatalities in the state, there are 65% of them in those three areas alone. There are other factors, but those are the three big ones. So I'm going to start in the area of impaired driving. What you'll see on the slides is some of our different advertisement, things that go on buses, things that might be in posters, things that might be print ads in newspapers and such, in the area of impaired driving. We've made tremendous progress in the area of impaired driving. We've gone from nearly 400 deaths per year due to drinking and driving to about 175. It's a big, huge drop, one of the steepest declines in the country. One of the things that's interesting in Oregon is that we do have within the definition of DUI different ways you can be impaired. And part of what we try and outreach is not just about alcohol. There are other things that impair your ability physically and mentally to operate the vehicle. They are included in the DUI statute, and you can be arrested and go through treatment and evaluation through those areas. But it's just sometimes people think just because it's a prescription, I'm okay. But sometimes the prescription says don't operate heavy machinery. Well, cars aren't that light. They are heavy machinery as well. So you have to be careful in relationship to operating the vehicle that you're not under the influence.
I have a question for you, Representative Berger.
Troy, everyone out there, people like me, know the alcohol limit that is statutory. What do you do about prescription drugs and marijuana, for instance, to measure impairment? Is there some standards in the statute, and can you refer me to those statutes?
Madam Chair and Representative Berger, when it is non-alcohol, the issue that the law enforcement officer has to prove is impairment. So very often that's why they have video cameras on the vehicle to be able to show that. There is no statutory definition of a level of measurement of marijuana or PCP or methamphetamine that says that that person is automatically impaired like there is for alcohol at 0.08. So the officer has to show physical or mental impairment in their description of the situation and, in turn, the chemical test to show that those items were on board. Oregon's definition of DUI is alcohol, controlled substances, which is a list, and a list of, in statute, of about 50 inhalants. Very specific. If you are under the influence of those and the officer can show impairment, then the process of potential arrest and discussion of that DUI goes forward. If it's something other than that, the officer cannot charge DUI and has to charge reckless or careless. But there's no statutory or administrative rule finite number that says this number of nanograms of methamphetamine means impairment. There are none that we are aware of across the country that specify, because all of us, when you deal with like prescription medication, body build, the whole, gender, those things react differently, and so there's a hesitancy within that industry, that the scientific lab side, to say pick a number. Where alcohol basically transcends everybody in all situations, there's more reliability to say 0.08 is impairment.
Thank you.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I think this fits into the context of this time slot of committee. Is sleep deprivation considered an impairment?
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, not under the DUII statute. If an officer was to come across where it is, sleep impairment, the actual piece of that, then the officer would very likely have to deal with some other element of statute, such as reckless, careless, failure to maintain lane control, but does not the ability to cite for sleep. One of the difficulties in that area is that there's no chemical test to prove that sleep was an issue. So someone can claim that they were sleepy, but there's no way the officer or the court or treatment could just say, look at that. Now, if there's an underlying chemical issue, then that's a different piece. But the sleep is something that's really hard to prove as far as according to statute for laboratory backup.
I on the way to work in the morning, sometimes I literally go by, I can see them, there's people sleeping, and their eyes are closed driving down the highway. So it's amazing.
Representative Widener.
Literally.
Representative Schaffler, I'm sorry that you're not able to do that, but I've mastered that art very well. Quick question, kind of a follow-up on the, as far as the impairment on drug use. Because the drugs are illegal, period. So now I just know, talking with some officers, that's a tough row for them to go to actually write a ticket. So they've basically told me the laws, alcohol they can do because you blow or you take a blood test and it's 0.08. Is there anything that you've heard of that we could help make this stick a little heavier for drug use or driving under the influence of drugs, particularly, because that's the one we need to go after?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Weiner, I'm going to go to the next slide because I would highlight actually the very bottom, not the speaker, but the one next to it. The Safety Division, has, as part of the impaired driving program, has been funding drug recognition experts. There are approximately 215 law enforcement officers that are the best of the best in impaired driving and dealing with being able to deal with their conversation, their investigation, understanding the rules, and we elevate and give them special training and pay for that for them to be drug recognition experts, and they get some quasi-medical-based training. So if there is a scene where there's somebody that's 0.00, but they're not right, the officer on the scene can call one of those 200 experts who has been trained specifically around the areas of drug impairment, different classifications, what to look for in relationship to horizontal nystagmus of the eye movement, as well as vertical pulse rate and other things are involved in that program. And we've tried to to attack that issue. You can see that we're near 1,100 arrests last year for drug-impaired driving, which is roughly 100 a month, three every day. Now, from a statute point of view, one of the questions is the definition of DUI is very strict in Oregon, which has its benefits because it's very supportable. The hard part for our officers is when they go through and show the case and show impairment, as Representative Berger was talking about. It's tough on those officers. You are absolutely right. Part of that is for us and for the police academies to allow them training to help them recognize and do a better job of the investigation and knowledge of what could actually be the situation.
Follow up?
Follow up.
Could there be, like, usually you can offer blood and usually urine's a good way to test this, but if they find they're impaired in the field, like a mandatory urine test or something like that, we all have to do it when we get hired, and if we're driving under the influence, I don't...
Madam Chair and Representative Widener, currently breath, blood, and or urine are potential ways of doing chemical analysis for substances. Breath will only pick up alcohol. Blood and urine is where you would pick up other substances. In Oregon, under implied consent, officer asks you to submit. You are supposed to submit. However, if you refuse, then there is a set of penalties in relationships to suspension, and noted that you are refusing to do the chemical test as you signed when you got your license under implied consent. Part of the process, if there is breath and there is a zero or very low, but then the officer's determination, you're impaired beyond, really that's not 0.02 or 0.03, you're much beyond that point of impairment, they can move to blood or urine, have the ability to ask that under subpoena that is given. Oregon is not a mandatory test state. There are states around us, such as the state of Nevada, Arizona, or what they call, sorry, this crude statement, but they're called blood states. That if you're under arrest or suspended, impaired driving, you will give a blood sample, whether you want to or not. Oregon law does not allow that. There are some states that do, and there's pros and cons with that from a from a programmatic realistic, because now officers are not phlebotomists to be able to draw blood, and you've got to deal with paramedics and some other things. But you are potentially can do blood, breath, or urine if the officer determines that.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hesitate to ask this question because I'm one of the target elements of it, but we're all getting older, and my question is, when it comes to impairment, age, and I'm wondering what the department's doing or nationally what's happening. In my practice in Ontario, we probably see one or two people a week who shouldn't be driving, and of course they're our clients, so we can't do anything about it. But I make sure I stay in the office until they're long gone as my protective device. My question to you is, what are you folks doing to get out ahead of this huge bulge of older folks that's going to be frequenting the highway?
Madam Chair and Representative Vance, a couple things I can offer. The legislature has had a hand in debating bills in relationship to a certain age and what's required for relicensing and that conversation, and have those policy discussions. As a department, we do talk about voluntary, that you have the ability to find that you're not prepared or able to physically or mentally control a vehicle. You still can keep your card and go to ID card, so you're not losing part of your identification for your number. There is also the medical reporting program that's out there, that for the medical side, the ability to say review of this patient, there's an incident where they lost consciousness or something along those lines and need to be reviewed to whether they should maintain their license. And there is also the anonymous independent reporting of individuals that then cause administratively a conversation to occur about being able to retain license.
Thank you. Is that we utilize that anonymous thing basically by telling relatives or family members about it and then letting them use their best judgment. But how are you promoting public awareness of that number?
Madam Chair, Representative Vance, unfortunately on this situation I'm going to have to pass and say that's contained within DMV. And so during their conversation for the medical reporting program, it's pretty sound, came through and put in place by the legislature, and DMV's done reports and tracking of clients and people that have come through there. I'd have to unfortunately take a pass and say either I can get back to you, or actually related to DMV would be best.
Thanks.
Yeah, and Representative Benz, that department is coming on Monday, and we'll get to hear what's going on. Representative Boone.
Yeah, Troy, I had a question about blood tests. Say you have a two-vehicle MBA, and the driver is drunk, has killed two people in the other car, and the driver's in critical condition, gets sent to the hospital, gets evaluated. These are all long distances. So you get where I'm going here. By the time they actually get out of the emergency department into recovery, how good is that blood test?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, putting me through good paces today.
Sorry.
Very appropriate question and very real for most of Oregon in that long distances to medical facilities. And when you have volunteers that are very often our first responders and paramedics, including a lot of the ODOT maintenance staff that are out there, their worries about the folks that are there and taking care of them, not about tests and some of those things. Your first priority is for the human life. There is a hospital reporting clause in statute. So the officer does have the ability once in the emergency room or once in the hospital to say, you had to do typing, blood typing, et cetera, in order to situate, would like a sample of that to be able to, though, in turn, use for the potential process of a crime of DUI or vehicular manslaughter, homicide, whatever that right title is there. Now, the officer in the lab that then uses that sample needs to know there may have been drugs given on scene, on route, and those things come into play. It becomes difficult, but there is the ability for the officer to gain that as evidence under current statute for hospital reporting.
Can they use what the hospital took? I mean, the officer doesn't always go in; they're still on scene in some cases. So by the time the person's in this hospital, then they're transferred. All that blood gets checked and then disposed of, or whatever happens. So that, I guess what I'm saying is, if that officer doesn't do that, can they call it in? Can they request it of the ambulance crew or something? Is that chain of...
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, the officer can make the request. The issue is whether the hospital will want to comply.
Okay.
Yeah, and so that becomes a discussion really with the hospital and their lab and that part of their program as far as dealing with blood and retaining. Do they retain it or do they flush it in relationship to... of dealing with the patient.
Okay, thanks.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, we've spent so much time on this. I just want to know how often this even happens. I mean, how often do you have an instance where a person's having blood drawn or you're, I mean, I can't imagine that this is that common of an occurrence.
Madam Chair, Representative Call. There are 25,000 DUI arrests in Oregon every year. 72 times every single day, 7 days a week, a law enforcement officer is moving somebody off the road because of their inability to control their car for impaired driving. 72 times every day.
Right. I understand that is an enormous problem. What I'm wondering is most of the time they're doing a field sobriety test, you're getting a breathalyzer test, like that. That's how this thing plays out. It's not this radical situation where you're always needing some sort of very intrusive kind of procedure to gain the kind of evidence that you need for a conviction, correct?
Madam Chair, members have called. Yeah, as mentioned in the second line, we have 181 fatalities, so every other day, there's a fatal crash where one of the principal parties had some sort of chemical on board. And so for the fatal crash, the serious injury crash, getting to the scenario of dealing with subpoena from the hospital, blood draw, it's not nearly as frequent. The breath test is by far the number one way that the chemical testing is done.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'd like to take a second and play for you one of our radio ads, and I may adjust the sound here a little bit for you. Before I want to introduce this radio spot, it is meant to go towards young individuals where there is a higher issue of a problem. It is actually in part aimed at both the young lady and the young man. And the young lady, the idea behind this message is to give them permission to not get in the car. Sometimes the perception is boyfriend or another male friend who tends to do most of the driving, they're my ride, so I've got to go. Even though I may not want to, there's this, you know, some sort of internal contract that I've got to go with them. The idea behind this ad was to, in a humorous type way, let them know there is permission to not do that. On the other side, to aim at the young male, is drinking and you know, wanting to drive with, you know, your female companion is not necessarily the right and macho thing to do. So it's aimed at both audiences, but it's aimed at that particular crowd set and that problem.
Okay, guys, listen up. This is what we like.
Thai food?
Yes.
You paying for Thai food?
Definitely. And we like it when you're for real. You know, none of this, oh, I really care about you stuff, and then treating us like dirt?
Totally. You care about me? Prove it.
Like, don't even think about asking me to get in your car if you've been drinking.
Yeah, what's up with that? Do I look like a crash dummy to you?
I would never put someone I care about in that kind of danger.
And don't play this, but baby, I can handle it thing. No, you can't, and I'll think you're lame if you try.
And guys who lose their license until they're 21 for underage drinking? Seriously, dude, lose my phone number.
You want to impress us? Be real. Show us you're cool without the booze.
Now, you're looking good.
Really good.
Drive sober. It's the way to go.
This message is brought to you by every girl you're ever going to know and the Oregon Department of Transportation.
So as a sample, that actually came out, the legislature debated the issue of losing your license for minor in possession if you fail to appear in court. You know, that was a policy choice by the legislature put in place. In part, that ad was a reaction to that to highlight the fact that you can lose your license if you're underage and you have an alcohol offense. I'm going to shift quickly, no pun intended, but to speed. One of the other three big areas, this is a sample of a billboard that is used. This last year, 216 individuals lost their lives in crashes involving speed, 47%. It is now, as you saw earlier, the biggest circle of the three in relationship to driver errors involved in crashes. DMV, it's a rather interesting number on the second bullet there, 176,000 speed-related convictions. That's not tickets. That's actually where they've been found guilty or pled guilty, and it got to DMV to be put on their record. There are those that, you know, are found not guilty or do other, you know, diversion-type programs through court. These are the ones that actually reach DMV as convictions.
Madam Chair, may I?
Yes.
We probably don't have 2008 yet, but we have an increased presence, a visible increased presence, I believe, on I-5 of state police due to the hiring increase. Is there any indicator showing that, and I come to work too fast, I'll be the first one to admit it, but I drive home at pretty good speed limit. Is there any indication that the speed-related convictions is decreasing due to the increase in hiring and number of state police?
Madam Chair, Representative Schaffler, we're going to have to wait. As you mentioned, 2008 is pretty close. For someone to receive a citation and then turn go to court and then in turn for the proceeding of court to reach DMV, you're typically on average looking for 90 to 120 days away.
Still in 2008.
Yeah.
I think, may I?
Yes.
Just them being on the road. I mean, I know if I see one, I slow down. So I bet it would probably show some kind of decrease.
Representative Daly, and then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps a little bit of an off-the-wall question. Clearly, the fatality and an impact is related to the force of that impact, and hence the importance of speed and its relationship to fatalities. But the mass of the vehicle is also related to that fatality. Is there a policy reason that you can see that we don't also incorporate the idea of the size of the vehicle into enforcement and into fines that are levied?
Madam Chair and Representative Bailey, you are right on in the opening comments in relationship to, you know, the speed is the compounding factor. And I think in the written testimony it's, you know, mentioned that if for every 10 miles an hour above 50 you go, you double the energy in that particular crash. Vehicle safety standards, airbags, seat belts, the roll bars that contain within are all tested at 35 miles an hour. So you see the stars and the rating on cars. The farther you go away from 35, the less effective those devices are going to be. Hence that 110 in that circle where they're just going too fast, even though they have belts on, they're still dying. It's the trauma. It's the second crash. The third crash. The crash, you into the restraints, and then your internal organs in your brain, inside your body, still moving at that speed, all of a sudden stopping. In Oregon, we do have a steep speed differential in relationship to the larger vehicles, the 55 on the interstates, when allowing passenger cars to go higher. There's, you know, various studies, pro and con, speed differential in that particular limit. But the policy choice by the legislature and Transportation Commission is that, you know, those numbers make sense. And you can, you know, for safety reason, just as you mentioned, you've got longer stopping distance for heavy vehicles, less maneuverability for larger vehicles, and that's why there's that speed differential currently on the interstate. Every all the other roads max are 55, which is equal to the differential on the interstate.
Representative Wyman.
Just wondering, with your previous slide, when you had fatalities and you said bicycles come into play, motorcycles, things like that, with the individuals that died in crashes, could we get a breakdown of motorcycles, bicycles that might have played in? Well, bicycles probably wouldn't play into speed. There would be a different category for them, but because we did have a time there where motorcycles, kids were flying down the freeways on the motorcycles at 100 miles an hour. I'm just wondering how many fatalities we had from issues like that and how many motorcycle crashes are factored into this with the speed.
Madam Chair and Representative Widener, there is a motorcycle chapter and a bicycle and a pedestrian chapter in the plan. I'll have to get back to you on the specific of that count, how many are speed, because I don't think in all three cases are we relating it to speed as much as just saying here are the number of pedestrians, here are the number of motorcyclists. So if you can, you know, gain a couple days of time, be able to respond to the speed across the different modes of travel and let you know of the 216, 2007, which ones were in each category.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead.
Third area is in relationship to occupant protection. What's rather interesting in this area is Oregon is the only state in the nation where the citizens voted in the seatbelt law. And that was done in 1990, and we've had a primary all position, all age safety belt law ever since, and that is one of the big items behind our ability to have such success in reducing death and injury. Also in that statute, and the initiative passed by the citizens, talks about appropriate use of the safety belt. As this crash test dummy, if you look closely at the right shoulder, you see it's underneath the arm. Well, that puts that belt in a very precarious spot if there is any type of even a small speed because of where it sits and the potential of where it comes across the body. That is also why you see the car seat, booster seat for children, because you're wanting to elevate their body so that it's hitting the large part of their chest, not across the throat, where that becomes, you know, dangerous in a low speed type of crash. We are one of the top five, now I believe this last year, top three in safety belt use for all of us as we're out in the traveling stream around the public at 97%. That 95%, the USDOT compares state to state to state, but it's only the driver and the front passenger. The federal language does not require comparing state to state to talk about anybody in the back seat. So we do both. While we're studying and looking inside the car for thousands of checks around the state, we're looking at all seating position, but also clarifying front in order to compare with other states. Women do buckle up more than men, so there's a challenge. And then the other issue is relating to small children. There is one of the colored monies coming from the federal pot is for car seats and for infant seats and booster seats. So every year about $100,000 of the budget from the safety division goes to low or no income families around the state to provide them with a seat because it's law, and B, the money we've gotten in Oregon is for that purpose. And so we worked with Department of Human Services and the health division and the hospitals in order to help get those out appropriately around the state where they are needed. This is a TV commercial, and so 30-second TV commercial, and I'll see, hopefully we get everything works for you.
Hey, get this tape in. I think you should have turned back there, man. You always get sloshed. Whoa. I think I all better buckle up.
I can't find mine.
Are you shitting on it?
Are you all ready?
All right.
Ready.
A crash doesn't wait for you to put on your safety belt. Buckle up.
And part again, aimed at the problem-identified audience of where belt use is the lowest. And quite often when you're doing focus groups, small clusters of these folks, and asking them why wouldn't they, or offenders that are in front of court, why aren't they, you know, forgot about it, didn't think about it. Well, I'll put it on when I need it. Okay, hence the issue here about showing you is that you don't necessarily have that time. A fourth program area is in driver education. Legislature in 1999 changed the teen driver licensing process and restrictions related to having a license and put an incentive towards driver education and moved driver education from the Department of Education to the Safety Division. And since that time, we've been working on updating the driver education program, making a difference with teens, updating the level of instructors and the curriculum that are used around the state, both public and private. This is a particular print ad that went with a radio ad, which I'll play in a second, that actually for the National Association of DMVs, this set of program in partnership with the Safety Division and DMV actually won one of the gold awards a few years ago across the country. This ad is very quiet. I apologize. I can't boost the audio on this ad, so you may strain a little bit. If I look at you and you all say I can't hear it, I'll move on. But this is the ad relating to teen licensing. It opens up with a couple seconds, actually, the behind-the-scenes chatter that the DJ hears to let them know what's coming up on the ad is running right now, and there is a real low tone.
It is low.
Parents are always saying that we teenagers think we know more than they do.
So, parents, here's your chance to show us you're smarter than we think. Are you ready?
Take Oregon's new teen driving laws.
You do know there are new teen driving laws, right?
Yeah. Do you know how many hours of supervised practice, preferably with you, we need before we can get a license?
And do you know who's allowed and not allowed to ride with us for the first 6 months afterwards?
Or what hours we're not supposed to be on the road for the first year we have our license? Anyone?
Don't feel bad if you don't have all the answers.
After all, a lot of things have changed since you got your license. Just call Driver and Motor Vehicle Services at 503-945-5000. Or visit the DMV online to get the information you need.
Or just ask a teenager. After all, we do know everything.
Right.
This message has been brought to you by the Oregon Department of Transportation, reminding you to drive safe.
It's the way to go.
What was hard to hear, I thank you for your patience going through that a little quiet. Behind the scenes, the music that was underlying it was music to play on the stations that the teens listened to, so that the public service announcement directors and others would be willing to play it, because it's not out of sequence or out of tone with everything else that's going on their station. Here's some quick numbers, and you have in the both the business plan as well as the printed copy some ideas on that. I'm going to just highlight two things. The very first number at the very top, 1998, prior to all the changes the legislature brought in play for driver ed and teen licensing, almost 1,200 16-year-olds behind the wheel when someone was killed or injured. 100 a month. 16-year-olds behind the wheel when someone was killed or injured. The latest year we have, 2007, that number is down to 621.
Oh.
That is a 46% reduction. Way, way better than any study on any program in Canada or the United States. The average is somewhere around 11 to 15% reduction. So I want to applaud you and those that are involved in driver education, teen driving, the licensing process at DMV, and everybody that stepped up. The reason why this is that way is because everybody took this seriously and made a difference, because that does have a huge play in the overall safety. And it's not just 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds. And the year before the law went into play, 1,500 17-year-olds behind the wheel when someone's killed or injured, and that's dropped all the way down to 961, which is a 36% reduction. Again, way better. So the restrictions, the training, it's carrying over to the 17-year-old, and we're starting to see the numbers in the 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old now that have gone through all parts of the law. It's affecting their driving behavior as well. And so all of us collectively should smile and pat ourselves on the back for doing a great job. Still more to do, but the fact that those improvements are that way is a very, very positive sign. Children, a few things I just wanted to mention about. We do try and work with Department of Human Services and Safe Kids and other Child Safety Seat Resource Center and others that are out there. But just want to remind you, as you're looking at kids, the number one reason for death up to the age of 35 in Oregon is car crashes. It's kids not necessarily being able to finish school. It isn't gangs. It isn't guns. It isn't suicide. It's car crashes. And so we focus on kids and have had a youth assessment of Oregon and a specific youth plan of what we're dealing with all across all the fronts: car seats, the minor possession, pedestrian training, bicyclist training at the schools, even providing the bikes for them to be able to do that training and repeat it there and show them how to maintain their bikes, why their helmets are the way they are, in order to try and have an impact. And we have had. The numbers in relationship to youth in Oregon have dropped tremendously. But it is a very tough area, in part because your main connection is with education, and they have a lot of policy and priority-related things that they're dealing with. And so sometimes we're there after school or part of a club or part of some other, with the Boys Club, Girls Club, you know, scouts and types of things to try and at least make available to them this. People don't understand. Up to age 35, number one reason for death is car crashes. General population doesn't necessarily get that. Numb to it in some cases.
Representative Joplin.
Thank you. What's the penalty for a child not being properly restrained in a car?
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, anybody under the age of 16 unrestrained in the vehicle, the citation goes to the driver. 16 and older, the citation goes to that individual. So if I'm a driver, have a child in the car, it's a $97 fine plus whatever court costs are there. If it does end up in a situation where there's injury or death, then you enter a whole different side of the criminal picture. The traffic citation is $97.
So if I'm foolish enough to have my baby with it isn't restrained properly, it's only a $97 fine?
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, correct, unless the law enforcement officer needs to find something to enhance it because of potential at-risk or endangerment of the child. But the officer has to prove a different level of action and activity on your part.
And then, Madam Chair, one more.
Yes.
Since, by virtue of being legislators, we're all mandatory reporters, is that considered child abuse, and are we mandated to report an unrestrained child in a car? By the way, my daughter was never unrestrained in a car. I've been unrestrained my whole life, but my baby's always been restrained in a car. And so the question, though, are we mandated to report that if we see that?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't know that part of the law. I would have to see whether that falls under the definition of child abuse.
Right. Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Representative Schaffler has piqued my interest. So is it the same ticket if they're in a seat and just not buckled in properly as opposed to standing on the back seat and with no restraint upon them whatsoever? Is that the same fine?
Madam Chair and Representative Call, you are correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sorry, Troy. One other question. If there was a parent with three kids in the car, none of them restrained, would it be three separate violations potentially?
Madam Chair and Mr. Brennan, it is potential. That's the officer in the conversation with that offender as far as what they're going to proceed with.
Okay.
Next area is in the area of motorcycles. As was mentioned, Representative Widener, you know, asked a little bit about what's going on with motorcycles, and we'll get that further information for you. This is another one of those siloed sets of money. The federal money we receive for this program is aimed at training or share the road. Part of the issue nationally is a lot of motorcycle fatalities are the passenger car and the driver not seeing them, pulling out in front or et cetera. And for the training area, we do get, the safety division does get the endorsement money. If the individual has a license and they get a motorcycle endorsement, that fee directs to the safety division. We in turn use it to do the motorcyclist training around the state. 21 and under, to get your endorsement, you must go through the training. For 22 and older, you can do the training and use that note at DMV, or you can go to DMV direct and go through the training there. The average age of people taking the course is between 35 and 40. The average age of deaths in Oregon is 43. It's not the young under 21 that are dying on Oregon streets and motorcyclists. It's us that are doing that. So our push in some areas is to say motorcyclists are just like you and I. They're not a different group, a different crowd. They're the doctors and the nurses and the teachers and our neighbors that ride motorcycles, and particularly this last summer with the gas prices changing, there was even, you know, more of that around. We have a recent radio ad, and I believe this will be the last one that you'll have to listen to. This one tries to take the car and the motorcycle and humanize them and talk about that issue of share the road, again, related to some of the federal money that we receive.
Welcome to Couples Counseling. I see you're a motorcycle.
Hi.
And you're a car.
Hello.
Okay, so how long have you been seeing each other?
That's just it. She's not seeing me.
I don't understand.
I feel completely invisible around her. When we're out on the road, it's like she looks right through me.
And how does that make you feel?
It kills me.
Oh, stop exaggerating.
No, seriously. When cars don't see motorcycles, that can kill me. Especially at your size.
Excuse me?
Okay. I want you both to take a deep breath and start sharing more.
Oh, you mean sharing our feelings.
No, I mean sharing the road.
Okay, and I'll try and stay out of your blind spots.
And I'll keep my eye out for you.
Cars and motorcycles, living in harmony. Ah, Now, about my bill.
Uh-oh, we're out of here.
Wait for me!
Don't forget to share the road! It's the way to go!
A message from the Oregon Department of Transportation.
In Oregon, we do have the issue of motor vehicle and motorcycle interaction, but I will submit to you that the last handful of years, the number one motorcycle fatality reason is the motorcyclists themselves. The most often noted in motorcycle fatal crashes is carrying speed into a corner and not coming out. They're not situated themselves correctly into the corner in order to make the corner. And so our training in Oregon, which is different than what most states do, focuses on cornering, focuses on speed, focuses on looking through the corner so that your vehicle goes where you want to go, because that just pops up over and over and over again. Another issue in Oregon is those riding motorcycles that are not endorsed. They've not been tested or trained. And so the Governor's Advisory Committee on Motorcycle Safety has presented the legislature policy question is, do you raise the level of the offense for riding unendorsed? And there's a set of data behind that, and that will carry with that bill, but just letting you know that that's one of those that is out there and starting on the Senate side for that particular bill to move forward. And then there are a lot of other areas that by statute, by request of the legislature, by request of citizen committees or others, to say we need to some sort bring up, raise the attention around some of these other things that exist in the traffic stream that cause me angst as a user of the transportation system, or we're seeing in the crash data or the citation data, such as red light running, areas around following too close. And so these are examples of posters, of billboards, and print ads that are in different places that we've done, you know, and you tend to, the last handful of sessions have had bills about turning your headlights when it's dark or when it's raining. And so one of the things we were asked to do was to do a comprehensive outreach program and highlight the issue of having headlights on in the rain and cell phones. And my bet is you'll probably have a conversation around cell phones up and coming. And so be in the room and help answer as best I can some of the data and other things from other states or other jurisdictions around the globe when they're dealing with cell phones. And then Oregon is rural. And so every one of these programs that I have mentioned, we have turned around and tried to focus on the rural aspect. As Representative Boone mentioned about the whole issue of the hospital, and in turn I respond in relation to the volunteer medical providers, the EMTs, and you know, that there's a lot of issue, and in Oregon, the number one road type that we need to deal with are the county roads and the secondary state highways, the 101, 97, 213, 217, 395, the roads that are not around the main population centers. When something happens, it's a long time for someone to get to them, and there's not necessarily a medical facility really close. And a lot of those folks that are first responders are you and I, volunteers, that have chosen to go sign up and get training and to help out. That in turn, unfortunately, has some issues, and we've had issues where, you know, open range areas of the state and farm vehicles on our roads that come around a corner doing your normal speed, and all of a sudden there's a farm vehicle there, and you've got to deal with it. And so we try and highlight as best we can from the education point of view and raise awareness prior to farming season and engage those that are involved as far as raising that up. This is, unfortunately, this table has about 25,000 fatalities on it. That's how many people, it's just in Oregon, since 1950, have died on our roads. 25,000 people. Now, what's amazing is you see that yellow line drawing down through the end. We have been making huge, huge strides over this past decade. Do you see the elevation of the bars keeps dropping? The set of bars, like every decade, drops again. And drops again, and we keep pushing that number down, and that's again, for a moment, all of us can smile. But at the same time, we know that that's still almost 500 people in Oregon every year are dying in traffic crashes. It's a fairly big number. When you sit back and think about it, it's at least one, sometimes two a day, somewhere, just because we have a transportation system in the state. As we forecast the future and we're trying to say the laws being put in place that you debate and put out there, the programs we're trying to outreach and problem ID, our goal by 2010 is to be below 400 fatals, when just a few years ago we were near 700.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sorry,
I imagine there's some population or demographic explanations to some of this, but if you look at that, just a glance, especially the one before, and the one you just had, that it goes like this. Have you? What explains that peak and valley downward slide there? It really jumps out at you.
Madam Chair and Representative Schaffler, I have the exact same reaction to this. There are certain events that have occurred in this stream, and if I can, I'll try and do the mouse over for you a little bit just to show you. This particular peak here of 676, 1988, 89, 1990, we as citizens voted in the mandatory safety belt law, and we went from 50% belt use to near 80. We saw 100-plus drop right in here,
yeah,
right around the time the safety belt use went in. Here, this drop was the year right after the legislature put in law the graduate driver licensing for teens. And so you see a reaction to the numbers that I showed earlier related to that. If you go back in time, you look at some of these others back in the 1970s, dealt with some of the DUI-related laws. So if you look at the big items as you go through, some tenuous connection, not an absolute one-to-one, and not something you necessarily can repeat because it's now law. And so you've got to refine and be a little bit more specific in what you're trying to do to continue to move that number down. So not, I don't think, and that's 100% be able to, you know, tie you, but there are some significant events on some of those valleys.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Yeah, Troy, do you have any figures on the number of, and this is not on the freeways, this is on the secondary, like the highways like 26, 101, a number of speed-related arrests over 100 miles an hour?
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, the Oregon State Police has tracked the, I call them centurions, the 100-plus that are out there, and then in turn the effect that the law that was passed about raising the penalty related to that or 30 above the posted speed, they've done some press releases, and so I can either check with them or refer them to the committee to provide that information. As far as broader across the state, Oregon does not have what is called a citation data file. Law enforcement, they don't, all across the state, city, county, and state police do not all send their citations to one database. The only data you really have on the citation side is the conviction, and that's when it gets to the DMV and it's put on the driving record, and that does not talk about location. It's just the offense, the class, and the penalty. It doesn't talk about location. So state police has tracked it, and recently because of the law change, and can ask them for that. But to get a broader answer to your question, it's not there unless we polled every law enforcement agency, all 175 of them across the state.
Thank you. Representative Widener, and then.
That chart is actually pretty impressive, especially with population increasing. But one of the questions I would have, we have speed related and everything. I would kind of be curious to look at weather relation too, because maybe it's something we need to address with snow and ice conditions. Are we having more fatalities then, or is it early in the mornings when there's ice on the road, black ice, different fatalities such as that, that maybe something we should be looking at to help you with your safety record? So more than anything, because I think as a group we need to figure out where we get the biggest bang for our buck.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. We have done daytime and weather-related data tables. Be more than happy to share those with you and the committee. When we've tried to look at, like, the incidents of just, you know, last month, travel goes down, and actually people are a little more cautious. Speed goes down. There are unfortunate incidents. We, from our point of view on the analysis side, haven't necessarily been able to tease anything out to say that we can try and address and be specific, but having more sets of eyes to potentially look at that and say that we might find a pattern or something that's there would be great. We'd appreciate that help and that feedback.
Representative Vance.
Well, thank you, Madam. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just noting that chart does reflect the demographic trends. It looks like in 1964, that's when all the baby boomers were turning 20, 30, you know, 18, 17, and then you can see the increase. And then the legislative response. So if you look at the next step, and in your chart earlier showed us it was speed, and we can anticipate, I suppose, that we're having smaller cars. Your recommendation regarding the next legislative fix to make that chart continue to trend downward would be what?
Madam Chair and Representative Bentz, if I could move forward real quick. One of the things we have done towards the future is that we're trying to achieve below 400 within just the next, you know, 2010. That was our objective. part of what we have done in the speed area, it is not one of those areas that has colored money from the feds. So for me to approach that, I have to take some of the discretionary money that could go to anything and roll it together and say speed. The Oregon Transportation Safety Committee, in tackling that area, this year created a one-year speed task force, and they are meeting this calendar year to do exactly, Representative, you're saying, what are the main policy things that we need to do, be it law, be it current, you know, using current law and applying it? Is it dealing with the way we equip and train law enforcement? Are there certain things that we need to get to you and I as road users and drivers to convey a message of what the risks are associated with higher speed from what's posted? From a direct today in the speed chapter of this plan, we purposely identify the 5 to 6 counties that have the highest number of speed-related fatals and injuries. So we then pull those 5 or 6 forward. We then go to the next layer of the discussion and say, what roads are those speed-related injuries and deaths occurring on? Is it a highway, which is state police? Is it county, because it's a sheriff? Or is it a city, which is dealing with the police department? And within that county, we bring together the sheriff's department, the Oregon State Police, and the police department and say, your county's on the list as being one we need to work on. We'll give you grant money, but you have to work together, similar to the days of the original saturation patrols and wolf packs for DUI, a multi-agency tactical team for speed. And these are the roads, and these are the times of day, and the days of week the speed's showing up. Use this money to go to those areas at that time solely for the reason of speed. Every county, the last 3 years that we've put money in to do that, has shown a drop in fatalities in their county. But it's a small bucket of money, and so we have the quick approach. What are we trying to do? Same time, we're stepping back anew and taking a fresh look at what do we need to do related to speed broadly, and have asked that speed task force, which has an engineer, law enforcement, media, AAA, orthopedic surgeon, around the table of 10 or so folks to purposely walk through this and give us the spectrum of what we might want to do with engineering, enforcement, we need it with EMT-related things, driver public education, and from the law point of view. So I'm not going to be able to, Mr. Representative, give you an exact answer, but it is one that we're working on.
It's a good answer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious to follow up on Representative Schaffler's question. I understood the part about where some of the drop-offs come from in that oscillation there, but I don't quite understand why every precipitous drop is followed then by a rise in fatalities. And it looks as if you've projected that same rise after a drop in your blue bars there. So I'm wondering if then you have an indication of what's causing that.
Madam Chair and Representative Bailey, the law of averages. If you will, regression of the mean, those that are better and there's a tension and then, you know, back. And that is proven out when you look actually across the country, and if you were to watch the numbers across the country, the same thing. You make a major movement, and then people get into a place of
complacency.
Complacency. Thank you. Whoever brought that. Exactly. That was the word I was looking for. A sense of complacency. And then, unfortunately, you get another tragedy, and it re-raises again. The best example I can give to you is in a high school. If somebody at a high school, a kid is killed, it is absolutely traumatic. The parents are involved. Counselors. It's something you don't want to have happen. But if something does happen, all of those kids, and the freshmen, sophomore, junior, seniors know about it. 4 years later, who in that school knows about it from the kid point of view? None. The freshmen have now graduated. So you have 4 years now of somebody that did not go through, unfortunately, that trauma. So for our point of view, we have to re-up that conversation every 4 years because it's a new set of kids in that age bracket. So complacency is some of it. A couple of the spikes, and I can mention just this last year, for instance, in 2003, this 511, we had an above-average number of multi-fatals, 3 and 4 people in a crash being killed, compared to when we've had them in the past. It's almost the same number of fatal crashes, but more people in the cars that there was a fatality involved. So I'm dancing around a little bit, Representative, but there's no, I can't give you a specific, 1970s, one of the things, and Mr. Representative Schaffler events talked about the vehicle type. That did have an impact in early play in the 1970s because of going lighter vehicles, higher miles per gallon on the vehicles, so lighter vehicles was an issue.
follow, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'd be interested, to the extent that data is available, to see more. It's a fascinating relationship because the intervals are so consistent. Looking across the years there, and I understand your point about complacency, but I have a hard time believing that the general public sees 518 fatalities versus 676 fatalities as being a major difference that's going to change their behavior significantly. And I would imagine that amongst those fatalities, the number and distribution of major accidents is probably fairly evenly distributed and probably doesn't change a lot from year to year, or at least it's random, I would imagine. And so I'd be curious to see a little bit more on the details.
And Madam Chair, Representative Bailey, part of that would be great, you know, discussion to sit down with you, talk a little bit about what we've got in here because of the different program areas. And you're right, in some cases, for instance, pedestrian fatals in this state, the lowest since 1944. Mm-hmm. But motorcycle fatalities over the last 8 years are going up. So you have a trade-off. You know, I'm not saying that's a one-to-one, but what's happened is pedestrians have gone down and motorcycle fatals have gone up. Mm-hmm. Youth tend to do that four-year cycle. You know, it within its own area does a four-year cycle. Vehicle occupants has continued to go down. Main reason is higher and higher percentage of safety belt use and car seat use for kids. So that area seems to come down. What's nice is the numbers are going down. You know, I don't want to see that yellow line going the other way as far as an overall objective and what's happening in this state. But be more than happy if we've got some time to schedule a more detailed discussion about what's in the business plan.
Representative Widener.
Just looking at the chart here, and you're saying 2007 was, looks like 420 fatalities, roughly, when I look at the chart here.
Madam Chair, is that right? Correct.
But when I flip over to 2007, we're looking at roughly 621 16-year-old drivers were involved in fatal crash injuries.
Madam Chair, Representative Weiner, 621 16-year-olds behind the wheel when someone was killed or injured.
And someone was so behind the wheel when someone was killed or injured.
Correct.
So that would mean there are at least 621 deaths.
Madam Chair, Representative Weiner, or injuries. The number of deaths with 16-year-olds behind the wheel is somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 35. Of that total, we're 16.
Fatal or injury.
Correct.
Okay. After that. So it looks like if we raise the driving age to 17, that would make a huge difference. And 18 would pretty much put you below probably 200 with your number.
Madam Chair, I'm going to say that one was asked of you.
No, I'm going to the expert here. Yeah. Nothing against you, Madam Chair, but the guy who produced the numbers.
Madam Chair and Representative Widener, there are some countries in Europe that have a different driving age of 18 and above, and absolutely, you know, their numbers are different than what for that 16 and 17 as they are within the United States all across the board. However, they have the same phenomenon. When you start driving and you're a freshman at driving, no matter what your age is, the first few years are the most risky. No matter whether you start at 18, 21, or it's your first time driving at 30, 40, or 50, that's a high-risk time period. And so the approach literally across the globe has been start out with some sort of graduated, restricted-type licensing in order to build the confidence, build the exposure, and to give the individuals the ability to learn in an environment that is the most safe that you can while still operating in the general public. There are debates and studies that talk about the mentality and mature level of 16, 17, 18-year-olds. By moving that number, do you lower the number of accidents, deaths? Very likely you would. You have a different impact on the mobility, you know, of individual families. And in some cases, these are individuals that are out on their own. At 17 years old, they're out of the house. So how do you factor some of those trade-offs in? Safety point of view. That would have an impact and lower the numbers.
Oh.
What if? Because right now we're 6 months that they have to have an adult ride with them, I believe, when they get their license. Or it's tied to hours. I mean, my two older boys went through this, and I got two younger boys coming up. So, and I don't care when they get their license because they just cost me more money. But if we extended that time possibly where they have a licensed driver riding with them, I mean, because those fatalities are probably, I would be curious to see, are they underage, like buddies riding with them, or is it a parent riding with them? And I will bet we will find very fewer with a parent riding with them or an adult riding with them.
Madam Chair, Representative Widener, the individual going through at 15 can get their permit. While on their permit, they have to do 50 hours of driving time with an adult. In addition to those 50 hours, they do another 50 or take a Department of Transportation-approved full driver education program prior to them getting their license. Once they get their license, the first 6 months, they can't have any other passengers under the age of 20 with them unless they're family. The second 6 months, the months 7 through 12, they can have three under the age of 20 that are not family. That whole year, they cannot drive between midnight and 6. During that whole time, they cannot be talking on a cell phone. At the age of 18, they then are eligible to then get a full-fledged normal driver license. If an individual says, I'm going to wait that first year because I want to hold my buddies around, I want to wait till I'm 17, it doesn't matter when you start. The clock starts when you start, so you still have the 6 months of passenger restriction and the nighttime restriction no matter when you start the clock with getting your license. At 18, there are no restrictions at that age, just Class C license like you and I all have.
Thank you.
Representative Bowen.
And this is just a question that I received from a constituent last session, and I had never heard of it, and I've never heard back. I didn't check up on it. It wasn't you. This guy had some sort of health or vision impairment and said there's a special waiver or something they can get to drive short distances on state highways. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, there is a law put in place by the legislature relating to bioptics with special training and a special lens. There is, again, that's a DMV-based program. And with a description of how one would qualify and, in turn, who's out there to be able to provide the training to the individual to know how to use the device and where their restricted driving patterns would be.
Thanks. Thank you. You're close, I think.
Very close,
go ahead,
Madam Chair.
Finish up.
So where are we so far this year? Through the 22nd of January, there are 17 fatalities around the state. This time last year, we're 26. In part, it is due to the weather. Less travel on the roads out there. And what's rather interesting is that second line, I should have circled that one as well for you, is that through the 22nd of January this year, one pedestrian fatality. Last year, by this time, we had already had six. And that's just an oddity. And so I'm just, again, wondering whether that's weather-related because we weren't necessarily out there walking because of the snow and the ice. And I want to say thank you, as I have mentioned throughout the conversation, thank you for being interested and being supportive of highway safety because you have done a lot. We've talked a lot about the teen licensing and the program there. Safety corridors, which are some of those stretches of highway that have proven to be troublesome, you have said that program and the ability to double fine and highlight those areas, that's a permanent part of the infrastructure and the highway safety program. You've dealt with speed limits. We've dealt with motorcycle helmets, safety belt. We had an unfortunate incident of that figure skater's mom that was killed in a shuttle at the figure skating championship in Portland. Right after that occurred, unfortunately, tragedy. The reaction of the legislature was, why do they not have to wear belts in those cars? And you closed that loophole. Helping, again, to have a safety show on our roads and streets. Rebuilding of the patrol division, the booster seat law recently, and one thing you have given to us, ODOT, is to do a pilot on using photo radar in a construction zone. And we are about ready to turn that whole program on in a particular project up near Portland. We have a requirement to report to you this March, but it sunsets in 2013 because we need to do the full program. And so we will be reporting to you on how that is taking effect. We're just now literally flipping the switch to make that happen.
Representative Edwards has a question. More comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Troy, you're using a full complement of media to get your message across. I'm curious how you assess the effectiveness of the various media programs to optimize the effectiveness.
Madam Chair, Representative Edwards, thank you. One of the things that my division does, we do not pay for time and space. So we're not buying TV time, we're not buying radio time, we're not buying print ad time. We are solely out there on the discretion of the individual station, paper, you know, owners. But we are typically the number one or number two recognized public entity for getting time and space because our stuff is well done. We spend between $400,000 and $500,000 a year for creation. Again, all 25 programs, $400,000 to $500,000 a year to create. We have reported 3 to 4 million in space and time. You probably, if you think about it, you see on the sides of buses around billboards. You probably have seen us. Now that you know it's out there, you're probably going to see it go, hey, it's Troy talked about that or showed it. How do we measure effectiveness? We do public opinion surveys in May and in August of every year. Mm-hmm. It's about a 30-minute conversation with someone that will stick on the phone. And we do it regionally around the state so we can separate Portland, Salem, Eugene, Klamath Falls, Medford away from Bend, Ontario, LeGrand, and ask, what have they seen? What do they recall? What do they know about these certain laws? And if we find out a certain push that we made about drugs and impaired driving isn't saturating, isn't in recall, we know either we've mishit or that's something we need to do a little bit differently. We do ask individual opinions and knowledge about laws that have passed. It's a sampling done in a way that statewide it's good, and in the five geographic regions, as Director Garrett pointed out, we have the ability to focus in on any one of those and see how we're doing.
Thank you very much.
So. And, Madam Chair, in conclusion, I would just again say thank you. Even with all the storms and everything last year, we posted one of the most, the lowest total fatal numbers in recent history during last year, only to have lower numbers in 99 and all the way back to 1955. And so we are doing good work. People are surviving crashes. One of the hard things about this is they don't know that they survived the crash because they didn't have the crash. Yet one death and serious injury is too many. There are too many stories about impacting families, communities, schools. And so our work towards approaching our performance plan and how we spend our money to do problem ID, at the same time trying to do something across the state in order to elevate the education and behavior of our walkers, bicyclists, motorcyclists, and drivers, as we take as our mission, because shouldn't be a cost of having 415 people killed every year on the on the roadways as a cost to having a roadway system. And so I appreciate your willingness to be involved. I applaud your efforts and those that have been here before and the legislators that were here in prior sessions in taking this up seriously and making a difference, because we are. And it's a one-sided, I can sit here and smile and present to you that it's positive. At the same time, I know there's a lot of work to do. And all of those that are watching online and the committees and the advocates around the state are making a big difference. So with that, Madam Chair, we're happy to answer any other questions the committee may have.
Thank you. And I don't know if there are any final thoughts or everybody's ready.
I wanted to point out that it was actually Representative Berger's constituent when she was 15, Krista, who worked that bill to get the safety belt loophole changed with Representative Dalto at the time. And then she came and worked in my office, and now she's working for you.
Good for me.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And Widener, Representative Widener.
Real quick, Troy, if you could get back to me at a reasonable time, just information on how many we have for ice, because one of the things that came up in this committee is shaded areas on the highways, so, and that being a problem for accidents, and that came from the county sheriffs that we heard that from kind of repeatedly, so that might be something we need to look into, because obviously we've addressed the teen thing pretty well, and even though I was saying 18, that would be kind of political suicide for us to all address that, and we'd have to start hauling our kids. So, but the shaded highway, the shaded highways, we could probably address and attack something there, and that might help you out with your fatalities or crashes.
Thank you. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you.